Today's Teisho will be on Case 98 in the Book of Serenity. Dongshan's Always Close. Introduction. Zhui Feng, cutting off his tongue, made a sequel to Shi Shuang. Cao Shan, cutting off his head, didn't turn away from Dongshan. The ancients' sayings were so subtle. Where is the technique to help people? Case. A monk asked Dongshan, among the three Buddha bodies, which one does not fall into any category? Dongshan said, I am always close to this. Commentary. In the original verse, not entering the world, not following conditions. In the emptiness of the pot of ages, there's a family tradition. White duckweeds, gentle breeze, evening on an autumn river, an ancient embankment, a boat remains, a single stretch of haze. I want to thank you all for coming here this morning during this Thanksgiving break. As you know, it was very cold this morning. When I got up, I heard on the radio that it was about 16 degrees outside. And when I was driving here, I saw on a bank display that it was about 20 degrees. When I parked out in the driveway here on campus, I looked up and the trees had lost most of their leaves, and just in the distance you could see the sun coming up. And it was so cold and so almost scary when it's that cold. It's a little bit frightening to have cold like that surrounding you. It's kind of a shock to your system. And I have to confess that when I woke up this morning, there was, I had the thought, ooh, it's really cold out there, and just stay under these covers. Mm-hmm. But when I was standing there looking at the sun coming up, looking at the bare trees against the horizon, which was sort of turning sort of reddish color, it was like being on the line between fear and joy. It was so interesting. It was like being on the line between fear and joy. It's the cold scary, but it makes you feel alive somehow. It's a very interesting place to be. And during Sesshin, sometimes it's like that. As you know, we often keep the Zendo a little bit cool in the winter during Sesshin. When you come out of your room and you go through the dining hall. The dining hall is usually at a decent temperature. It's like 70 degrees. And then you go into the sitting room, into the Zendo, and it's cold. And it's slightly frightening. It's slightly intimidating. And then you sit on the cushion, and at first it might be a little bit uncomfortable. But it really can help your sitting. And all of a sudden you can have this feeling, which is like joy. I sort of learned this the hard way, because when we were when I was training in Seattle, at one point we had sitting at the Roshi's residence, at Genki Roshi's residence, which was called Kuge-an. And we would all get up in the morning and drive to Kuge-an, his residence, which was up on a hill. It was actually a very beautiful place to live. And we would go in and sit. And every morning he would open all the windows when we would sit. So it didn't really, you know, matter what the temperature was, Genki Roshi would open the windows, and I'll tell you, that room was so cold sometimes. And I could just, sometimes we'd get there and I'd sit down and he wouldn't have opened the windows yet. And I would think to myself, you know, he might forget today. You know, maybe he'll forget. You know, this is, or maybe, you know how the mind works, you think, you know, maybe it'll be okay. You know, maybe he won't open the windows today. Even though he's opened them every day for years, you know, maybe he won't do it today. And then he'd open them. And then the cold would rush in, you know, and I would sit there in the cold, in the dark, day after day, you know, week after week. And for a long time, I really disliked it. But after a while, I really began to love it. And it's not something you love, you know, in an automatic way. It's not something you love, you know, the way you might love the taste of sugar the first time you taste it. You know, it's slightly scary, and then there's like joy. It's like thrilling, right? Maybe that's what we mean when we say something is thrilling. It's not exactly comfortable, right? But somehow it pushes us into a deeper life. And so, you know, sitting in a cold zendo is not something anybody would choose to do. You know, the reason we have central heating in where we live is that we like to be warm. We like to be comfortable. But, you know, once you're warm and comfortable, it's very hard to actually, I think, sit well. It's an odd fact. You know, people, sometimes I'll ask them how their sitting is during the evening sits. At the end of the evening sits, I'll say, how is your sitting? And people will say, oh, not so good, you know, I stayed up all night, I'm a little bit tired, you know. And I often feel, darn, what a shame, they don't see it yet. But sometimes when you're struggling with something like that, you're tired, or you feel worn out, or you're sick, you know, it's an interesting thing, but in that condition, you can have a kind of openness that that you can't have if everything's, you know, a-okay, everything's just as it should be. You know, sitting when you're sick is a little bit like sitting in the cold, actually. You know, it's not something anyone would choose to do necessarily, but when you do it, it's an interesting experience. It's slightly frightening, you know, and yet, you know, it's very, there's a kind of openness to it. You know, especially if you're really feeling rotten, you know, you can sit on the cushion and think, why am I doing this, you know? And then at first you might feel very weak, very shaky, and if you stay with it, you know, from my own experience, I would say you can begin to get into this place that's really, this, like, joy arises. This is to me quite important. You know, so much of our lives are based upon a certain kind of, sort of like undercurrent of fear. I have had moments in my own life of real insecurity. When I got out of college, for example, I started looking for jobs, and I was nervous all the time. I would go to these job interviews, and I was nervous going into the interview and often disappointed leaving the interview. And I would go home and I would be nervous, you know, just because I thought, what will become of me? You know, there was like this undercurrent of fear in my life. I had friends of mine who were not English majors. They were like engineers or they were business students. And when they graduated, they immediately got jobs. It seemed to me, anyway, that they immediately got jobs. And their lives seemed so coherent and planned out. I had a friend of mine who was an engineer at the University of Virginia, where I was an undergraduate. And even before he graduated, he sent he had sent out like 50 letters to different firms, and they were flying him out to places to interview. Even I was working as a night janitor at a bowling alley toward the end of my college experience as an undergraduate, because I was trying to make ends meet. And my friend was getting flown out to these companies in California. So we were like already sort of living in different worlds, and he seemed to have his act so much together. And I had like, I began to develop this undercurrent of fear. It was like, you know, what's going to become of me? What's going to become of me? And I would go to these interviews, and I almost felt a little desperate. I remember going to an interview to work in a bank. And the man who interviewed me was not very nice, really. He wasn't a very nice guy, as I recall. And he had somehow agreed to interview me, but then he looked at my resume and he said, well, you know, it looks like you've studied English and anthropology. And he really kind of said, what makes you think you could work in a bank? And I felt like saying to him, well, why are you even interviewing me if you don't think I would work out here? You know, I tried to talk about why I might work in a bank, but you know, I really didn't. I felt like, you know, I want to work in a bank because I want a job. You know, that's why. You know, that you have a job and I want one, right? But that wasn't, of course, the answer I gave, and it probably, I don't think it would have been the answer that would have gotten me the job, right? I don't know what I should have said, you know, but. All of this sort of added up for me to like an undercurrent of tension. And I had this feeling like, what will become of me? You know, what is going to become of me? And I had all of these lessons that I had learned growing up. You know, my father was he loved to give me sort of like lay down the law or give me little sayings. So he would say, you know, if you don't work hard, you're going to be a ditch digger. When I was starting out in high school, I wasn't doing very well. I didn't get very good grades. My father used to come into the room at night to see me, and he'd say, you know, Kurt, if you don't, you're going to be a ditch digger if you don't apply yourself. I had never actually met a ditch digger, but it sounded like a terrible life, you know. And so I actually began to study just because I was afraid I was going to become a ditch digger. You know, later I actually did dig ditches. When I was in college, I had a summer job on a construction site and I dug ditches. You know, I thought, this is not so bad. In fact, I liked it. I actually enjoy it. You're outside, you know, you look at the sky. Physical labor is actually good for you, fresh air, you know, it's very nice. But in the 10th grade, it just seemed like the end of the world, right? It just seemed, oh my God, I'm going to be a ditch digger. I better learn algebra, you know? And in fact, I did. I actually became very good in math, you know, and applied myself. And so, you know, somehow when I got out of college, these lessons were in my head, you know, that you're going to be a ditch digger, you've got to, you know, it's a dog-eat-dog world out there, blah, blah, blah. And so I was in this transitional period, and I just had this sort of like undercurrent of anxiety all the time. Like, what is going to become of me? And one of the jobs I had was managing a hotel restaurant. I became the manager of a restaurant, and it was a hotel restaurant, and manager sounded like such a good title. It's like, well, you know, this is a job worthy of my abilities, right? And But actually, it was a terrible job. I had to get there at 7 in the morning, and I would sometimes get home at midnight, you know, because I had to attend to every detail. And even though the sign on my door said manager, you know, if a cook didn't show up at breakfast, I had to put on the apron and go out there and flip the eggs, you know, with the other cooks. And I had to do all the ordering. And if somebody wasn't happy with his food, I had a suit coat, and I would put on my suit coat and go out and say, I'm sorry you didn't like your shrimp, you know, I'll give you some more shrimp, would that help, you know, and I had to try to be, you know, smooth things over. And that was really a difficult job, you know. And again, I had this terrible feeling like, you know, what's going to be, I can't do this for the rest of my life, you know, what's going to become of me? And, you know, I just think that many people have this feeling, this kind of undercurrent of anxiety about not being in the right place, you know, not being able to achieve what we want I don't know what it is. I think it's a very basic fear, sort of like a fundamental distrust in life. It's like we're not going to be what we should be. We're not going to be where we should be. You know, we're not going to, you know, something we need or want is going to never be given to us, or it's going to be taken away from us. This is like very deep fear. And I think many, many things in life contribute to creating this sort of deep elemental fear. Maybe all humans have it. You know, I've certainly had it at various points in my life, you know. It's like something is going to be taken away, and it's going to be irretrievably terrible, you know, when that happens. My mother used to always talk about her ship coming in. She would say, when my ship comes in, and this was one of those sayings that, you know, my mother had her share of these sayings too, and I can see why my father and mother were attracted to each other. You know? Because my mother would say, you know, when my ship comes in, you know, this is going to, I'll get a new car, or, you know. So there's this idea, someday it's all going to be right. And maybe people are really afraid their ship is never going to come in, you know, never going to come in. I think also, you know, that our culture really preys on this fear. It really speaks to this fear in a kind of a deceptive way. I have a friend of mine who's really a wonderful guy, you know, and his wife also, wonderful person. They're really humane people, generous people. And the other day I was having lunch with this friend of mine, and he said, we were talking about his remodeling job on his kitchen, and he said that he's spending $50,000 remodeling his kitchen. And I was just astounded, you know, I just thought that was astonishing. And the interesting thing is that he's been in agony over this just about every day he's been going through this process, you know. So I've seen him fairly often, and this has been like a theme in our conversation. So, you know, one of the problems was the cabinets weren't installed right. Or another problem was that the stone, they brought the countertops, but they weren't right. They weren't the, you know. So there was this just like one frustration after another. And I have the feeling, because, you know, I live in this culture too, you know, I have the feeling that they started out on this process to remodel their kitchen with the idea that, you know, if they just made some changes, it would be a little more comfortable place. You know, but I think the ball gets rolling, and it's hard to stop it. You know, because you start going to showrooms and you start seeing, you know, the perfect kitchen. And then you start thinking, well, you know, we don't really want countertops that are made of formica. Why not the Corian? And then somebody says, but you know, you could have the granite, which is what my friend has settled on now. It's the granite. granite's only a little bit more than the Corian, and that's a little bit more than the Formica. So, you know, pretty soon you're in this thing for $50,000. And you have to ask yourself, you know, I won't say this to my friend because it's, you know, I hope he has a wonderful time in his kitchen. You know. I won't, you know, and I actually like him enormously, and I wouldn't want to criticize him or something, or be, you know, holier than thou sort of thing. But you have to ask yourself, was this necessary? You know, was it really necessary? And, you know, sometimes if you do ask that question of people, they get upset. You know, they'll actually get upset. You know, because I think that what drives this is a kind of elemental fear. It's like, you know, you're trying to take, and if you say, you know, why are you doing this? You know, it's like you're taking something away from me that is, you're taking my dreams away from me. You're taking my dreams away from me. Yeah. And so, you know, people will actually sometimes respond in a hostile way if you say, well, you know, what, do you really need this kind? You really need cherry cabinets? Do you really need, no. You know, there's a kind of a feeling I think people have that if I can just get the granite and I can just get the cherry cabinets with the old world doors, you know, I'll be there. And by implication, if I don't get these things, I won't be there. You know, I won't be there. And I actually think this is seems like such a trivial matter. I have another friend who also remodeled his kitchen about maybe 5 years ago. And when my friend, who's currently in the remodeling process, was talking to me, the words of my other friend were sort of in my ear, ringing in my ear. Because my other friend said, that he and his wife had been married for like 18 years. And he said, we've always gotten along well. He said, the first really terrible fight they ever had was over the kitchen remodeling. And that actually makes a lot of sense if you think about it. Because people get so invested in these projects because it's like, if I don't do this, my ship is not coming in. You know, it's like, This is my dream. You know, if this dream doesn't come true, you know, we won't have wonderful breakfasts in the morning with our sitting around the counter. You know, the eggs won't taste as good. You know, that sort of thing. We know it's sort of ridiculous, but people are driven by this. In the most compulsive way, it's like if this doesn't happen, everything is lost. You know, if this doesn't happen, everything is lost. And I actually, you know, there's so many forms. This takes so many forms. You know, another friend of mine is a very good scholar. His field is. 20th century literature. And he's written kind of a controversial book. And at one point he was in a deep depression because there's a press called Duke University Press. And in English departments, if you get a book at Duke University Press, you are the coolest cat in the neighborhood. You know, if you publish it in like Cambridge or Harvard, you're doing really well. But if you want to be really cool, if you're really like cutting edge, avant-garde, you know, you're really the daring person, you publish at Duke. And my friend was like very, very deeply depressed for, you know, some weeks because he didn't get his book published at Duke. It's like, and really troubled, you know, it's like really, it really like shook his foundations for a while. And this is so common, isn't it? We think if this doesn't happen, it's all over. It we might not even think it intellectually, but we so often behave as though, you know, we're so often driven by this kind of undercurrent of fear. If this doesn't happen, everything is lost. It's all lost. You know, it's all gone. And we live our lives, I think, very often driven by these kind of unspoken compulsions. I have colleagues I work with who are actually upset a lot of the time because somebody else in the department at the same level makes slightly more money than they do. And you can, again, you can say this is so trivial, but it's tied up with this feeling, my life just won't be right if I don't make as much as Bill, you know. So there's something wrong, I think, with the way we live, sort of constantly trying to fulfill our dreams and constantly afraid that that if we don't bring them to realization, don't make them real, you know, everything is going to be lost. A monk asked Dongshan, among the three Buddha bodies, which one does not fall into any category? Dongshan said, I am always close to this. Now, the Buddha bodies refer to different aspects of reality. In Buddhist philosophy, different aspects of reality are characterized as a term for them. And one aspect of reality is called Dharmakaya. This is like a fundamental awakenness. One aspect of reality is called Sambhogakaya. This is like the function of fundamental awakenness. And then one aspect of reality is called Nirmanakaya. These are like terms that are used in Buddhist philosophy. And so the monk is asking Dongshan a kind of an abstract question. He's saying there's supposed to be these three different aspects of reality. Which one is the one I should hold on to? Which one is the one I should hold on to? Which is the supreme reality? Which is the one where I will be liberated, enlightened, happy, safe, etc.? Which one? Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya, which one? And Dongshan says, I am always close to this. As far as I'm concerned, the practice of Mu is the foundation of Buddhism, the foundation of Zen, and the foundation of awakening. It's so important to be happy with nothing. And it's so important to be happy with nothing at all. And the truth is, you know, if you can be happy with nothing at all, you can be happy anywhere at any time. You don't even have to do Zen practice to know this. Right? You know, I can tell you from my own experience, or I can suggest to you from my own experience that you know, some of the best times in my life have been times when none of the things I wanted to have happen happened. So, in the case of my early life, I got out of college, and I went for some interviews, and I had a series of jobs that weren't very good jobs, including managing a restaurant. And I started working for a newspaper in Washington State for like $70 a week, and I had to pay for my own gas and everything. And then I got a letter from a friend of mine, Larry Sullivan, who was taking a year off before he went to law school, and he said, why don't you come down here and let's spend the summer and go backpacking in New Mexico and Arizona. This was not part of my plan, but I actually just went down to New Mexico. I got a job in an Italian restaurant and began to cook. And by the way, I love to cook, you know. I really discovered that I love to cook. And not only did I get to cook, but you know, I got to spend several months, you know, months actually, doing things I had never dreamed of doing, but which turned out to be just wonderful. Living up in the Rocky Mountains, bathing in rivers, hiking up in the snow in the middle of the summer. It was really amazing. And later, after that period in my life was over, I just happened to run into somebody who mentioned that a Japanese monk named Genki Roshi had come from Japan and was teaching Zen. It was not part of the plan, nothing I expected to do, but really was the most wonderful event. Really, meeting Genki Roshi was one of the most wonderful things that ever happened to me in my life. So, you know, even if we don't do Zen, you know, there's a kind of, we all have this experience that sometimes the best things in life are not what we want to have happen. You know, we think if this doesn't happen, it's the end. And then something else happens that opens all these doors for us. But on a deeper level too, you know, how does he put it? I am always close to this. I am always close to this. When we sit on the cushion, we have all kinds of expectations and dreams about enlightenment. It's inevitably so. When people start doing Zen, they imagine that enlightenment is going to be like this, or enlightenment is going to be like that. Maybe you went to hear the Dalai Lama and you think you're going to, you know, who knows, the Dalai Lama laughs all the time. You know, who knows what it's like to be the Dalai Lama. We all have an imaginary image of that in our, you know, and, you know, so we get involved with Zen practice. We sit up, we learn to sit, we learn to focus the mind on the breath, you know. And the most interesting thing begins to happen if you just watch the breath. You know, you sit on the cushion, and of course your mind is filled with all of these thoughts, urgencies that turn out not to be so urgent. And you watch the breath, and you watch the breath. Little by little, thoughts begin to dissipate, and you become aware of the breath. You know, very, very interesting. And you begin to feel better. Breath, breath, breath. You know, and then at some point, if you just keep watching the breath, a very interesting event takes place. You know, you can't watch the breath anymore. It's like it disappears. I don't know if you've had this happen to you, but if you watch the breath long enough, it's going to happen to you. You know, you watch the breath, you watch the breath, and at some point, it's like the breath is gone. It's just gone. And when the breath disappears, other things may disappear too. You may feel like your hands or your face have disappeared, or parts of your body have disappeared. It's just gone. And this is actually something people don't appreciate. This is something people think of as rather trivial or even a problem. People will come to me in Dokusan and say, I'm trying to focus on the breath, but it keeps disappearing. And for me, this is like, what? It's like, congratulations. You know, this is wonderful. It's not a defect. This is an encounter with the fundamental reality. Not reality that we learn from philosophy or even from science, but the experience of the world, the world we experience directly in meditation practice. It's like if you watch your breath long enough, it disappears. And you're left with a kind of nothingness state, so like emptiness. And actually, it doesn't really matter what you focus the mind on. If you bring the mind back to the object of attention long enough, the object of attention disappears, and just for a split second, your mind becomes blank or dark. And again, this is something that people think of as so unimportant or trivial at first. It's like, well, so what's that all about? I don't know. We want to fulfill our dreams, and we want to live the good life, you know. And so, this little blankness, this little darkness, seems so unimportant, so unimportant. But this is from the Buddhist standpoint. This is the face of Buddha. This is the face of Buddha itself. When you follow your breath out, 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 the end of your breath, there's like this little blank spot, this little emptiness, yeah? And it seems like nothing at first. And nothing in our culture has really prepared us to appreciate what it is. We might say, and it's a psychological anomaly or something like that. It's very important. You know, I think all cultures at some point in their development have discovered this blankness. And in our culture, we don't appreciate, or we aren't prepared to appreciate what it is. But it's absolutely like, that is the face of God. That is the face of Allah. That is the face of Buddha. The other day I was doing some work in the library. And I came across something that was really striking to me, because it was written in the 4th century by a Syrian who was a Christian monk. And he was talking about meditation practice. And he wrote a book called Mystical Theology, is what he called it. And in that book, he talked about how to get to what he calls the ultimate cause. We would say the source or the root. And here's what he wrote. He said, we pray that we may come into this darkness, which is beyond light, and without seeing and without knowing, so we can see and know that which is above wisdom and knowledge. That's stunning, isn't it? This is somebody from 1600 years ago, not from China, not from India, from Middle East, different religious tradition. Let me just read a little bit more. He said, as we ascend to the highest level, we will perceive that the ultimate is not a soul and it's not intellect. It doesn't have imagination, opinion, reason, or understanding. Nor can it be expressed or conceived, since it has neither number nor order. It's not great or small. It's not equal or unequal, similar or dissimilar. It's not standing or moving or at rest. It has no power, and it's not power, It's not light. It does not live. It's not life. It has no essence. It's not time or eternity. It's not subject to intelligent contact. It's not science or truth. It's not kingship or wisdom. It's not one or many. It's not God or goodness. It's not spirit. It's not fatherhood or motherhood, nor anything else known to us or to other beings. Neither does anything, it is neither darkness nor light, nor the false nor the true, nor can any affirmation or negation be applied to it. The unique cause of all things is beyond all affirmation, and the simple preeminence of its absolute presence is outside every negation and every assertion, free from all limitations and beyond them all. Now that really could have come right out of, that sounds very much like the language of the Heart Sutra. In the Heart Sutra, we're told, the ultimate, the source has no form, no mind, no body. Just same, exactly the same language. It's this little emptiness that you encounter when you sit on the cushion and you watch your breath and the breath disappears. Or you call Mu and suddenly the mind becomes blank and empty. You know, I'm really convinced that this is, there's something to this. And dwelling in this state is a little bit frightening. It's like being in the cold, right? You know, the first time you encounter this state, it's slightly scary. But if you stay there long enough, you know, the most wonderful thing begins to happen. Everything you encounter in that state becomes beautiful, wonderful, alive, part of yourself, sufficient. If this hasn't happened to you yet, please keep sitting. You sit on the cushion and you watch your breath enter this blank state. And then, you know, you hear a bird, or you see light falling on the floor, or you go to eat, and you look at the rice in your bowl, and you feel like you're staring into the face of your mother. This is the most beautiful thing in the world. Where my second teacher trained, Myo Shinji, all the monks would get up in the morning and wash their faces in cold water, icy cold water. They don't heat the temple. Monks are sleeping if it's 20 degrees outside, it's 20 degrees in the room where they stay. When you go into the bathroom, no hot water, it's just a bucket of water. And you take some of the water and you splash it on your face and it runs down into the basin and down into the drain. And I'm sure it's very difficult to put that water on your face. Many years ago, in fact, I actually saw a movie about Myo Shinji Temple. And I went with Webb Sensei to the movie. And I remember sitting next to him and watching the monks put water on their face, and the steam was coming up from their faces as they washed their faces. And they were going so slow. They were reaching into the water and just putting a little bit on their face, and then the steam would come up. And I asked Webb, I said, why are they washing so slow? And he said, because the water is freezing cold. And I realized the steam is not produced by the water, it's produced by the heat of their face. Right? But the important thing is that on the basin, there were four characters on each of these basins. And the characters, are really, there's the four characters mean I only know wholeness. See, I only know wholeness. Now, you know, it's possible to go around all day long and just say that to yourself, you know? So, you know, if you are driving home today and you're worried about some problem, you can sit in the car and go, I only know wholeness. I only know wholeness. Well, you know, good luck with that project. I don't think it's going to work, right? It's like if you have a bad temper and you keep telling yourself, watch your temper, you know, it's not going to work, right? Change has to take place on a deeper level. I think we have to recognize that we all have like this elemental fear that if this doesn't happen, my life is ruined. Or if this doesn't happen, I will never be fulfilled. You know, if I don't get this job, it's the end of the world. You know, if I don't get published in this journal, I'm finished. You know, if I don't get that, you know, whatever it is, if I don't get those granite countertops, we'll never have a happy breakfast, you know. Right? Ever. It's just not like that. But there's some, it's too deep an impulse to just, you could walk around saying, I only know wholeness, I only know. I believe that you have to go through the door of mu. I think this is our way of life. You know, this is the Zen way of life, is to constantly come back to this emptiness. This, we say, mu shin. And you know, the beauty of our path is that if you go into mu shin, you know, you just try it. You know. What happens is that in that state, everything becomes pure, everything becomes holy, everything becomes alive, you know, without exception. See, this is, by the way, I think something that the writer, that 4th century Syrian, didn't know, by the way. And he understood that what we might call God or enlightenment is in some sense beyond form, you know, beyond all of our understanding. But you know, the other aspect of our path is that once you're in that state, you know, the world of form becomes heaven itself. And this is our way of life, right? This is the Zen way of life, is to live in emptiness. And you can say, well, that's a very barren way of life, I would say. Living in emptiness doesn't sound very inviting. But when you live in emptiness, when you spend some portion of your day in mu shin, see, you can say, you will say, if you just stay there long enough, I am always close to this. See, I am always close to this. Everything is Buddha. Everything is perfect, just as it is. And the door to that perfection is not $50,000 on your kitchen. It's fortunately much less expensive than that. The zafu is $50. The zavatan is $50, right? All it takes then is your time and energy and your commitment. Right? You sit on, and you just have to stay there long enough to enter that blank state, and then all your problems are solved, right? And it's so wonderful. I mean, you know, I have, as some of you know, I have a job as an administrator, and being an administrator is an inherently unsatisfactory job. You know what I mean? Because there's always a new problem. So if you're problem averse, you shouldn't go into any kind of administrative work. Because no, as soon as you solve this problem, a new problem arises, right? And it's possible to be very frustrated all the time. Always disappointed. Oh, and things are never right. Things are never, ever, ever right. But for me, you know, for me, this is so wonderful because no matter what goes wrong, no matter what goes wrong, you know, I spend my hour or two every morning on the cushion. And I sit and I enter that blankness and I hear a bird, or I get off the cushion and I feel like laughing. You know, it's just the most wonderful. I go outside, feel the piercing cold on my face. I feel so, this is my true self. You know, it's just, these problems are like rice. They're like your nourishment. All these obstacles become like rice. They sustain your life. We pray that we may come into this darkness which is beyond light, and without seeing and without knowing, to see and to know that which is above vision and knowledge. The cause of all things transcends all affirmation and negation. The simple preeminence of its absolute presence is free of every limitation and beyond them all. I'm always close to this. I'm always close to this.